Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to be talking with Tony Juniper about his new book, Just Earth, How a Fairer World Will Save the Planet. From soil loss to wildfires, degraded rivers, mass migration and conflict, the environmental crisis is already here, and it's set to get much worse. And while billionaires build remote bunkers and make plans for colonies on Mars, climate collapse impacts the most vulnerable among us first and hardest. What this book proves is that inequality isn't just about who suffers the consequences. It's the main obstacle to blocking action, has been for decades. How can people lead good lives without ultimately hastening global collapse? The answer lies in fairness. We can't fight climate and nature crises without addressing the ever-widening gaps between rich and poor, the powerful and the weak. Tony Juniper, CBE, is a prominent environmental figure active in defense of nature for nearly 40 years. He's led major organizations, run global campaigns, advised at the highest levels of government. His books include the multi-award-winning What Has Nature Ever Done for Us? And Harmony, which was co-authored with His Majesty King Charles III. He's received many awards and widespread recognition for his environmental work. In 2017, he was appointed Commander of the British Empire, CBE, for services to conservation. He's now chair of the British government's official conservation agency, Natural England, and a fellow with the University of Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership. Tony Juniper, thanks for joining us today.
Hello, Tom. Yeah, great pleasure to be here.
You're joining us from Cambridge, I understand.
Cambridge, England, that is correct. And with the miracle of the internet,
we're
in the same room.
That's right. We love Zoom. So, it's great to speak to you. How did this particular book come about? What was the impetus here?
Well, Tom, as you kindly pointed out, I've written quite a few over the years. And this one was in gestation for quite a few years. I was thinking about some of these fundamental linkages between big environmental issues and big social issues, and reflecting on how very often we treat them as separate when in fact they're fundamentally connected. And the more I thought about those connections, and as I began writing Just Earth, the more it became apparent to me that we can't solve the environmental problems unless we simultaneously solve some of these huge issues of social inequality and division, which block progress at almost every turn. And I think the impetus really for writing this particular book came from a conversation I had with a former Swedish environment minister back in 2008 in London. We were sitting at a dinner together, and I asked her why in Sweden they seemed to be so much further ahead on environmental solutions than we were in the UK in conserving nature, reducing pollution, switching to renewable energy. And she said to me, it's very simple. It's so much down to how we are more equal than you are, she said. And I thought that was a very interesting answer about equality being at the heart of why Sweden was doing so much better than we were. And I got thinking on the back of that remark, looking at issues that I'd been involved with personally for many years, and decided to write Just Earth. And I began writing in about 2021, and the book came out this year, 2025.
So give me an example or two of the blockage there, that this is, not only noticing that there are disparities, but that this is a main block to progress.
Well, at its most basic and simple level is the huge disparity that exists between people who use up a lot of resources and produce a lot of pollution compared with those people who use very little. And one study that I cite in the book reveals the difference between an average American citizen and an average citizen of Burundi, a little East African country, in terms of the relative greenhouse gas emissions produced by people living in those two countries. And it reaches the conclusion that an American citizen is responsible for about 500 times as much carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere as one of the people living in that poor East African country. And so you can see right away a fundamental blockage in terms of meeting global targets in that case to reduce heat trapping gas emissions arising from these just really quite enormous disparities between rich and poor. And when you look at the extent to which we are already over the limit of what we would regard as a safe level of CO2 in the atmosphere, you realize that we can't carry on as we are without doing something about equality of environmental impact, because those poor people in Burundi, they do need to produce more CO2 because they don't have enough to eat, they don't have piped water, they don't have decent housing, and they don't have enough energy. Therefore, if they're going to lift up their standard of living, we're going to have to do something about the pollution being caused in the West. And this needn't necessarily mean a reduction in living standards, but what it does mean to say is that we need to see a reduction in environmental impact. And so that's at its most fundamental level, just a very practical difference between how much stuff we all use up as citizens on this little tiny planet that we inhabit. But there are many other linkages that come from these inequalities. And in this country, and I'm sure in the United States, you see when it comes to key issues like food, like energy, like water, where we need to do better on the environmental side in reducing pesticides, conserving soils, switching to renewable electricity, cleaning up our rivers, all of these things. Very often we find that we can't make progress in getting stronger policies or the investment needed, because very often the plight of poor people who can't afford food, energy, or water bills, these are held up as the reasons why we shouldn't invest in improving the environmental performance in those sectors. And so there's a couple right there, Tom, of reasons to be seeing inequality and environment as majorly linked. And of course, on top of that, you have observations from around the world that when you do get major environmental disruption coming from climate change or pollution, then usually you see a pattern whereby it's the people on the lowest incomes or who are most marginalized or who are the non-white people who get hit first and hardest by the pollution or by the impacts of global warming. And I touch on the book in Just Earth on the case of Hurricane Katrina that hit New Orleans in 2005, so 20 years ago last month, and how that storm differentially impacted on the poor black people much more than it did in hitting the better off white people. And again, it's a pattern you can see across the world where the poor are more vulnerable to environmental damage. And so it's quite ironic in some ways that it's the poor and the plight of poor people that is held up as the reason why we shouldn't take firmer and stronger action to fix environmental problems. And so it's really a weave of different themes like this that I seek to draw together in the book to paint a picture of why we can't fix environmental issues without fixing social issues at the same time.
I want to follow up on that last there, because it's you do see this often. People speak for the poor, right? They're not speaking to the poor directly. They're saying, well, we can't do this, that, or the other. You bring up an example of solving the water issues in Great Britain. We can't do that because the poor aren't going to want to bear the cost. So I wondered, so how do we, first of all, is that true? Do the poor generally not want these issues, not want to these solutions?
Well, there we are. That's a very good question. Is it true? When it comes to energy, I think increasingly we can see that a reliance on oil and gas is what's going to keep prices high. And so I think we can increasingly make a very strong case to reveal how a switch to clean energy sources is going to be the best way in which we can keep bills down for poorer people. When it comes to food, it's more complicated, but inevitably, the mix of issues that are in there leads one to see that, making the case for cheap food is really something which is not serving the people who are eating the cheap food, because it leads to all sorts of problems of health, which in turn is not very positive for the people who are not being fed properly, and which in turn costs society an awful lot of money. And in this country, our National Health Service now is really struggling to keep pace with chronic disease, some of which is linked with inactivity and poor diet. And this is leading to chronic illnesses, which are costing the health system a fortune. And so, not only is it something which you look at in terms of the costs to the people who can't afford to eat properly, it's also a social cost that comes through too. And are there ways of dealing with that? Well, yes, there would be, because food, if you want to eat proper food in this country at the moment, and I'm sure it's the same in the United States, it does cost more to have decent healthy vegetables and fruit and locally procured meat and these kinds of higher quality foods. So how are we going to find ways of being able to make that more affordable? Well, one way we could do it is switch the vast subsidies that governments pay to food producers at the moment to be making enormous economies of scale, growing things like corn and wheat and maize. Could we instead switch some of those subsidies to be encouraging farmers to grow more healthy fruit and vegetables and producing that at scale, thereby pushing prices down? An interesting question. I think probably it would be possible in many geographies to do that. And certainly we should be looking at all the tools that we have to be able to move in that direction. When it comes to water, one of the things I propose in the book, because we do need to invest more in water in this country, and we're in the unique position globally, really, of having fully privatized water utilities. And so these are private sector companies with investors. They're regulated by the state, but basically they need to charge money from the water consumer in order to be able to invest in the infrastructure needed to sustain the water supply. So reservoirs, treatment works, pumping stations. And we have no distinction in those bills between people who are using a small amount of water to meet their day-to-day needs compared with those people who are filling a swimming pool. They're still paying the same amount per litre or per gallon of water. And so one of the things I propose is that we should find ways in which we can differentially charge between the high consumers who are using a lot of water for luxury purposes compared with consumers who are using water for basic day-to-day needs, and finding ways of being able to reflect that subsistence compared with luxury consumption, because one level of consumption, i.e. the luxury consumption, is putting more pressure on the system. Arguably, it's not as essential as making the basics of life available to people. Therefore, one way of keeping bills down for those on lower incomes would be to be charging more for water as you get into very high levels of consumption for non-essential uses. And so these kinds of ideas, I think, are out there to be looked at and tested. But of course, these are highly political ideas in the sense of whether we wish to go down this route of changing market signals in order to be able to meet both equality and environmental goals at the same time. And I think it's fair to say that the appetite for going down that road is mixed, depending on which country you are in.
I want to follow up with that. You've been involved in all areas of this, right? Including politics, I think.
Yes.
That's an understatement. So the politics is loaded on this, right? how do you, if you're an environmentalist, how do you navigate that? How do you persuade more people?
Yes. Well, this is a very interesting question, Tom, and wrestling with this book for a few years and drawing on many years of experience, I reached the conclusion in the final chapter that one of the big problems we have is the extent to which any political discussion is divided into left and right. Everything has to be, is it right wing? Is it left wing? the left wing criticizes the right wing and the right wing criticizes the left wing. And we have a big ding dong about socialism and capitalism and the market and state control and all of these things. And I believe that this is an increasingly sterile debate, which really doesn't reflect the times that we are in. And if you look at the origins of our capitalist system, or the origins of the socialist or communist systems that have run in parallel in some parts of the world, they had their origins really in the 20th century, in their modern manifestations. And I think it's fair to say that both have failed in terms of their ability to solve these massive and worsening global environmental problems. And so at the end of the book, I propose a new idea, not capitalism, not socialism, but an idea that I've called thrivalism, which is about 10 billion people thriving on a living, vibrant planet indefinitely into the future. And there would be elements of market economics in that, but there would also be a whole range of other tools that we could use to be able to manage our increasingly serious impact on our small planet. And one of the main ideas that I suggest we may wish to investigate is the notion of replacing our reliance on GDP growth as the overarching measure of progress that we slavishly endeavor to grow at every turn across the world. And instead we replace GDP, gross domestic product, with GPI, genuine progress indicator. And the genuine progress indicator would seek to measure more than simply how much stuff we're all using up, which is what GDP does, and instead to come with a much more sophisticated measure, which looks at happiness, longevity, social cohesion, environmental sustainability, levels of mental illness, the number of people in prison, and coming with something which really reflects the needs of modern society, rather than assuming using up more and more resources is going to contribute to good outcomes. Because basically, that is what growing GDP seeks to do. And at the same time as using up a lot of resources, it's making the world very, very unequal. And that inequality, as I explain in the book, is making it impossible to fix these environmental challenges. So I think we need a new idea. We are at a crisis moment in the early 21st century. Climate change is now taking on really quite terrifying proportions. We are depleting the resource base, including fresh water and soils. There is a mass extinction of animals and plants gathering pace. None of this is inevitable. None of it is necessary. If only we can find a way of accommodating a good life for everybody in the world at the same time as we repair the environment. And I would just add one thing, because I keep saying that word environment myself. It's a problematic word. It gives the impression that it's about choices that are separate from the economy. I think what we should start doing is changing the word environment for the phrase life support system, because that is what we are degrading, our very life support system. And if we can't find ways of meeting our needs without destroying our life support system, I think that's not economically very sensible. So if we do move to a sustainable economy, meeting everyone's needs and preserving our life support system and improving it, I think that is worthy of a new political idea which supersedes the old and tired ideas of left and right.
Do we, you're highlighting income inequality, it's a big block to progress on these issues. Do we have to, I don't know, not solve this problem, do we have to ease income inequality before we get progress?
Yes, and I'm not arguing even for a world which is totally equal. What I'm suggesting is that we might wish, for reasons of ecological sustainability as well as fairness, wish to travel in a direction which leads to a less unequal world. And, you know, I think most people, if you ask them, is some level of inequality tolerable, then most people would say yes, because some people work harder, some people are more talented. We need incentives to enable people to want to get up and do things and to excel. And I agree with all of that. But what I don't agree with is the now extreme inequality which has arisen as a result of running an economic system which has basically been captured by very very extreme financial elites. And, you know, some of the figures on this now are really quite staggering, to the point whereby, for example, about 3,000 billionaires in the world, that's not very many people, they now control more wealth than the entire bottom 4 billion people who live on planet Earth, many of whom can't afford to buy decent food, can't afford to heat and light their homes, and can't afford some of the basics that many of us take for granted. So should that wealth be more fairly shared across the planet in order that everyone can lead a good life? I think so. And I find it quite hard to think of a situation where, for example, $20 million or £20 million, if you had that as your wealth, I can't imagine in a normal human lifespan that anyone would need much more than that. Unless, you know, there was something linked with their ego or some political power that they wish to have or some domination over the rest of the population. I find it very hard to see what the argument is in favour of literally unlimited wealth, because it leads to some really bad outcomes, which we're now seeing. And actually, I don't have a problem with wealth or the ability of people to become rich. It's the consequences of that that I have a problem with, in terms of these serious and growing environmental problems that we now see before us.
So as you point out, this inequality is getting worse, not better, right? How do we reverse that?
So I mentioned one thing already, Tom, in terms of how we might arrive at some different outcomes, which first and foremost would be through measuring progress differently. So if we were measuring to achieve growth in the genuine progress indicator, I think we would have different behavior compared to our efforts when we're seeking to increase growth in GDP. And so we have a whole range of tools then that come behind that. And one of them I've already mentioned is government subsidy. A lot of governments are investing in industries which are making environmental problems worse, whether they be in the energy sector or in the food sector, for example. And if you look at numbers prepared by the International Monetary Fund, they suggest that subsidies being paid to cause worse environmental outcomes are now in the order of about $7 trillion per year, an enormous amount of money, which is being transferred in ways which is hastening environmental damage. Another would be through looking at the taxation system and thinking about ways in which we might find revenues for governments that come from taxing wealth. And I know that in the United States at the moment, there are attempts underway to reduce taxes on the very wealthy. I think this is the opposite of what is needed, but I'm not an American citizen, so I don't vote there. So, you know, that's not really my issue. But the point is that, you know, if there is going to be a fairer allocation, then one way of doing it is through taxation, as I mentioned, subsidies. And another way is through the financial sector and the way in which the financial system works and whether it could be geared to be investing more in the industries of the future and investing in social enterprises that are going to be leading to more equitable outcomes. And doing that through companies which presently are governed in order to achieve as much profit as possible for the shareholders, and instead migrating those companies to be more purpose-driven. So is it possible for us to conceive of a way in which a private sector organization, which is presently at the moment geared up to maximize shareholder benefit, could we conceive of governance structures which would say that instead the objective of those organizations is to improve sustainability and human well-being? It's quite an interesting thought experiment, apart from anything else, as to whether we could do that. But again, all of these things that I am saying, they are deeply political. They are about big choices, about the direction of a society. And at the moment, obviously, in most countries, we are finding it quite hard to open up even a discussion, never mind to make progress on the kinds of things I'm saying, not least because the media, and I don't know who owns your station there, Tom, but most of the media in the world today is owned by organizations linked with great wealth, who I think it's fair to say don't really wish to engage with the kind of conversation you and I are having this afternoon. It doesn't really fit their worldview and therefore doesn't get a lot of airtime.
Let's take a brief break. We're talking with Tony Juniper. His new book is out and available, Just Earth, it's called. Subtitle is How a Fairer World Will Save the Planet. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Tony Juniper. His new book is out and available. It's called Just Earth, How a Fairer World Will Save the Planet. He asked, how can people lead good lives without ultimately hastening global collapse? And the answer, he says, lies in fairness. We can't fight climate and nature crises without addressing the ever-widening gaps between rich and poor, powerful and weak. And we have Tony Juniper with us for the hour. Pleased that he's been able to join us. Tony Juniper, I want to jump back to an example that I found fascinating of how all of this is interconnected in ways that maybe we don't think about. You cite an example of Afghanistan. You talked to a former general there. Maybe you could tell us about this. I found this unexpected, the connections that you found here.
Well, same here, Tom. And I was very surprised during the course of that conversation with General Nuji, who was in the British Army for many years and served two tours of duty with coalition forces in Afghanistan some years ago. And it was an example, really, of how these impacts of climate change, in this case, hitting very disadvantaged and vulnerable communities, can blow back and be like a boomerang effect in hitting countries that are better off. In this case, including the United States and the United Kingdom, both of whom committed a great deal of effort in Afghanistan militarily in order to defeat the Taliban. And the linkage with the climate story came from work that General Nuji did to try and understand where the Taliban was gaining its strength in terms of recruits. And one thing he discovered was the linkage with declining and failing agriculture in the Hindu Kush region, where each spring for centuries, the farmers have relied on the gentle melting of the snow in the mountains to water their fields. Their crops were irrigated in a predictable way every year when the snow gently melted, starting in spring, running through into the summer. And then more recently, what has happened is as a result of there being less snow to start with, and then it melting all very quickly at the beginning of the spring, a pattern has emerged whereby there is a flood followed by a drought. And this effectively destroyed the viability of agriculture. And so the many tens of thousands of people who lived there, who were growing crops, which they used for food, and some of which they sold for money, suddenly the farmers found themselves destitute in many years. And General Nuji pointed out to me how the Taliban spotted this, and they recognized that the people who no longer were making a living from agriculture, they might be recruited into joining the Taliban. And he told me that he estimated something like 80% of the strength of the Taliban force was derived not from ideological converts who were fighting for a cause, but people who basically had no money to feed their families and therefore were willing to receive $10 a day to fight alongside those Taliban groups. And if they killed a British or American or other coalition soldier, they would get a $50 bonus, is what General Nuji came to understand. And so this was a backdrop to that conflict, which really didn't enter the news, to my knowledge, until I spoke to somebody who was there, who was involved and who was doing that work to understand the enemy better, and who reached these really quite surprising conclusions. But I think this is actually a common factor in different parts of the world when people begin to look at the strategic implications of climate change and other environmental issues. You often find that it's the people who are studying security risk who are the ones who really get this. and really understand the profound change which is underway and the extent to which it might have these unforeseen consequences, which in Afghanistan, it wasn't the only thing, of course, which led to conflict there, but it was a material factor that made it more difficult for the coalition forces to prevail in the way in which they intended in defeating the Taliban and gaining control of that country to be run in an orderly way for the benefit of the people who live there. And subsequent events showed that we didn't succeed, of course, and we now have the Taliban back in control with very, very, very unpleasant consequences for the people of that country.
Here's another thing that jumped out at me, that a connection maybe I hadn't made, maybe many others have, but you say that global warming is very likely to lead to market collapse. If we get to certain degrees of warming, could you flesh that out for me?
Well, this is one of the surprising things that one comes across when looking at, again, these implications, which may not be immediately obvious. But it's striking how one industry has stood out amongst the many sectors, economic sectors, that will have to grapple with the impacts of global warming. And that sector is insurance. Now, of course, insurance is all about risk and pooling risk in order that should something go wrong to an organization, that it can cover its losses because of unforeseen circumstances which caused it to have an expensive set of damages to its operations or to its assets. And so insurance, of course, you would expect to be a very interesting bellwether when it comes to the impacts of climate change, because the effects of severe storms like hurricanes, of floods, of sea level rise and of fires, all of these things can lead to expensive payouts for people who are covering risk. And increasingly we see this around the world. And indeed, just as I was putting the final touches to this book back in January of this year, we had perhaps the most dramatic example of all of a major insured loss occurring as a result of what was arguably a climate-related disaster. And that was those terrible, terrible fires that hit Los Angeles. Long, dry period of weather, 8 months without rain, fueled by very strong winds, which fanned fires that broke out in the suburbs of that enormous city, leading to a conflagration, which I think people are still working out the total insured losses in Los Angeles as a result of those fires. But above $10 billion were some of the early estimates. Now, if you're in the insurance industry, you have limited scope in terms of what you do about this, because you can't immediately stop global warming on your own. So you can either withdraw insurance and say that you no longer cover homes in Los Angeles for fire, or in North Carolina for flooding, or in New Orleans to storm damage, or you can put up premiums and charge much, much more to cover those risks. And both of these things are problematic from an economic point of view, of course, not least because some properties become uninsurable, and that is likely to hit the people on the lowest incomes the hardest. But also, being unable to insure physical assets has ramifications for the banking sector, because banks raise loans, very often secured against collateral, and they won't release a loan unless that collateral is insured. And if you can't get insurance for your collateral, then you can't get a loan. And that begins to affect investment flows and begins to harm the wider economy. So the idea of insurance being hit, it's like a keystone in the wider global economic system that we have at the moment, and could have really quite serious consequences more widely should the effects of global heating continue to ramp up. And there's no reason to believe that they won't do. And even if you're a skeptic of the climate change science, just have a look at what the insurance companies say, because those people, they are working with data in a financial setting. They're not ideological environmentalists. Those are people who are seeking to ensure the global economy in order that it can continue to function. And if they're beginning to signal a problem, I think everyone should really pay attention. And they are beginning to signal a problem.
You talk about indigenous peoples. I want to have you expand on that. A couple of points. Indigenous peoples are stewards of some of the last key remaining forests, right? That are so key, and the way they think about land and ownership is maybe a model that we could follow.
Yes, it is, and I really bring in the indigenous voice into the book because one of the observations I make, Tom, is that, you know, the challenges we face now on the environmental side is not only about information and data and technology or government policy. It's about our collective worldview and the extent to which our culture across the world is really seeing humankind as embedded in the natural world rather than separate from it. And one thing which is very different between the culture in Europe or North America compared with the indigenous worldview, or there are still indigenous people in North America and indeed in Europe, actually, but the mainstream culture of those countries, one big difference is the extent to which the indigenous societies see themselves as bound up with the health of the natural world. They don't see themselves as separate, living in an economy which is utterly divorced from the earth. They see nature as not only beautiful and also as a spiritual presence, but also something which sustains their well-being and indeed their economic system. And, you know, the last thing that indigenous people living in the tropical rainforests of the Amazon would see as in their interest is cutting down the forest and replacing it with a monoculture of crops, because they know that would be not only the end of their worldview, but also the end of their sustainable economy, which depends upon the forest for food and shelter and medicines and everything else. And so that difference in perspective, in overall philosophy, really, is something which I think we need to seek to rebuild in societies which have become increasingly distant from the realities of how our planet works, because our planet still works as a life support system based upon the cycles of nature. And in many Western countries, we've now become so divorced from that that we can no longer see even this basic reality. And so this is why I think it is important to bring the indigenous worldview into discussions about the future, including at global summits, where increasingly those voices have been prominent and influential on the global stage in climate change negotiations and in discussions about the future of nature and biodiversity. Those people have been bringing a voice which is offering to share their wisdom and to combine their wisdom with Western science and technology in order that we can build a partnership between the enormous capabilities that we have with our modern technologies and capabilities, but using those in ways which is guided by their traditional knowledge and their perspectives about people living in harmony with nature. So it's quite a broad point I make with the indigenous perspective. But I do think that it's an important one to reflect upon when, you know, even though we have all the technologies, we have all the policies that we need if we chose to use them, we are still not doing. And I think that is in some part down to our worldview, which no longer connects us with the natural world.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with the final segment with Tony Juniper. His new book is out, available now, Just Earth, How a Fairer World Will Save the Planet. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're pleased to have for the hour Tony Juniper. We're talking about his new book, out and available now, Just Earth, How a Fairer World Will Save the Planet. So I want to get into some of the other, in one of the final chapters in the book, you list 10 areas which must change to make an overall change in the environment. But before we get to some of the, we talked about several of those already, before we get to some of those, I want to get this in, make sure we get this in. You've said that you are optimistic about the future. And you quote Dwight D. Eisenhower, This is very important for you. I wonder if you talk more about this, expand on this. He said, if a problem can't be solved, make it bigger, which seems counterintuitive to me. Tell me about this.
Yes, exactly. So Dwight D. Eisenhower provides us with exceptionally important wisdom in our modern world. And having been involved with these environmental subjects now, Tom, for more than 40 years, I'm amazed to note, they've been getting worse rather than getting better. And I wonder if General Eisenhower, or President Eisenhower, as he finished up, brings a very important point for us. Because, you know, if we can't solve the environmental problems by focusing on environmental issues and environmental solutions, do we make it bigger? And also to embrace social questions and questions of equality, and indeed questions of economy, which is exactly where I finished up writing this book. And so I felt that he had a really, really important point there for anyone concerned about the future of our world and the sustainability of our civilization, and looking to conserve and preserve it and to make it better in the future. It's no good simply, I think it's fair to say, simply focusing on climate changing emissions and arguments about renewable energy, or simply on how big our national parks could be, or how much pollution a factory could release, because we've been doing that. And whilst we've made some progress, we've not made sufficient progress. And therefore, do we need to do something wider and broader? And I think the answer is yes. And so I think Eisenhower's remark there is very much in the spirit of the book, in terms of how these profoundly important environmental questions, huge though they are, probably need to be seen in an even broader context if we're going to be able to fix them.
I want to bring up a couple more possible solutions, right? Things that need to change. One that stood out to me, you say our culture needs to shift. We need to consume less. We have too much stuff, at least in first world.
We do. I tell you what, Tom, one thing whenever I speak about these subjects to an audience here in the UK, and I guess it would be quite similar in the United States, people say, well, what can I do to help with these big issues? And one thing I say, well, can I ask a question back? And can anyone in the room who doesn't have enough stuff put up their hand? And everyone bursts out laughing, because everyone's house is full of rubbish and clutter and things they've accumulated. And they've not done it because they need it, or because they have to have 55 shirts in their wardrobe compared with the 10 that would be sufficient. It's just because we're consuming at every single turn. And we're encouraged to do this by advertising and marketing, which has created a culture of what I think now is overconsumption. And there probably was a time back in the 1960s when we hit a sweet spot, when for the first time, ordinary folks could afford to have things that previously would only have been owned by very wealthy people, whether that were a car or a house. But we've now moved into a space whereby we've now taken on consumption patterns which are unnecessarily excessive. And this is not to say that people shouldn't have nice things or they shouldn't enjoy life. Far from it. My point is that perhaps we would enjoy life more if we used up less stuff and learnt to be thinking about not only what we're consuming in terms of a greener alternative to this or that, but actually just how much stuff we're consuming overall, and to be thinking about whether we might wish to say enough is enough, and that we do have enough things in our house already, and therefore, you know, let's try and draw the line and spend our money on better things, enjoying life, maybe better food, spending time with family and friends, and spending less, therefore, on things which are going to finish up quite quickly in a landfill or in an incinerator or drifting in the ocean as waste plastic, which increasingly is the case. And if we did that in Western countries, might we free up some more ecological space for people who have literally nothing to be able to have a dignified and more secure existence? So that consumerism point really is exploring some of those issues. And not to say that I want people to live in deprived circumstances or not to enjoy nice things, but just to ask ourselves whether we have enough. And if we do have enough, maybe we could save a bit of the environment by not unnecessarily having more that we don't need and which isn't going to make us happy. And actually, I remember an old colleague of mine years ago who had a rule that he used, and it was a rule of thumb. He wouldn't let anything into his house unless it was both, either or, useful or beautiful, and ideally both. And so beautiful, useful things were allowed in, things that would add to clutter and just make the place full up with rubbish. He tried not to let them in. And maybe there's something there for us all to reflect upon as we're thrust into buying circumstances day in, day out with our smartphones and our tablets telling us to buy, buy, buy. Is it really helping? Is it really making us happy? And that in the end is a cultural question, because we have drifted into this over the last few decades through the efforts of advertisers and product promoters. And it's linked to what I said earlier on as well about our collective philosophy and the extent to which we've parted company from the ancient wisdom of our forebears, who saw themselves as inhabitants of a living planet rather than simply being consumers of stuff. Big questions, mm-hmm. but I think important ones.
We're just about at the end of our time here, about a minute left. I wondered, just an overall view of this conversation, your book, what do you hope that people, what one idea do you hope people take away?
Well, the book is really an invitation to think, Tom, and to just stand back and look at the world and some of the challenges we live in. I think if there's one big idea to take away, it would be about the way in which we judge progress. Are we measuring the right things to know whether we're proceeding in a good way as societies across the world, in the US, the UK, France and Germany? We're all obsessed with growing our gross domestic product, growing our economy. Is there something better we might all seek to grow? Sustainable living on a tiny small world, drifting in the emptiness of space. Can we find a way of growing human well-being in that confined area that is our common shared future? And I think that's the one thing to take away. And again, it's a big question, but I think if we don't have a conversation about the big questions now at this particular juncture in human history, then we'll be missing a very, very important opportunity for change at a time when we really need it.
Well, interesting, important book. The book is Just Earth, How a Fairer World Will Save the Planet. The author is Tony Juniper, and he has been with us on the program today. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.